won't attempt anything other than to accent words which are accented differently in American, in the American way. For example, a word like details is very clearly details in American, and it would ruin the rhythm to mispronounce that. But what I thought I'd do for half an hour or so is read just a very few poems from the five or six books that we, Anvil Press, have published recently. In fact, we had five books out on May the 31st, officially. And one book, Peter Russell's All for the Wolves, which is in fact not technically published until, I think, July the 12th, which has just come in. So I thought I'd read just a very few poems from each of those books, and then read a rather simple selection from Jane Cooper's Scaffolding. The poem I admire most in the book is the longest, is the most impressive in hearing, but I really don't feel I could do any sort of justice to it. All I can really do is recommend the poem to you. It's the poem called Threads, Rosa Luxemburg from Prison, and it's a long poem. It takes approximately 15 minutes when she reads it. I think it's a magnificent piece of work, but I've rather gone for simpler poems which don't need any particular explanation or inflection. So, actually, I don't think I'm going to read something from all these books, because, for example, my favourite poems of John Matthias are longer poems. And actually, the funny ones I wanted to read aren't in this book, but anyway. I thought I'd start with a couple of rather light pieces by E.A. Markham from his book Human Rights. Again, the most impressive pieces in this book tend to be long poems, and I really don't... I've never heard Archie read, and I don't feel I could do them. He's West Indian. He's actually in Papua New Guinea until about this time next year. The only thing I can say in justification of my reading the poems is that Archie's accent is even more Oxford British than mine. Although perhaps some of the performance pieces he reads he tends to do with a slight tinge of Caribbean patois, but not much. I thought I would just read one or two of the lighter pieces, or rather, not lighter. There is a section of performance poems, which is the last section in the book, which are satirical and do work awfully well when he reads them. But I'll read some of these poems from a section called Games and Penalties, which are often ironic poems. For example, Anonymous. At the wrong end of the room, my life waits for me. It's grown attractive over the years, defeating villains who would possess it. Time to cross the room. The view of the street remains alien, so I must reclaim what was never mine, homecoming for the unloved. Such journeys are more difficult than words, and my room empties several lives as I get to the bookcase, pretending to need a book. My life does not wait, but battles with its villains to return a little more soiled. Naturally, we apologize to each other, as I'm too embarrassed to leave home. We fill the room with concern, with souvenirs for evidence of the world's untidiness, till I'm pressed against the walls with you again outside, part of the life of the street which is still not mine. As I grow smaller than the world, I haunt large rooms in disguise and speak to strangers as if they were strangers and wilt early in the evening. And the second one, a complacent little poem greets a revolutionary big poem. Listen, think of something else. The hose is being turned off, blood washed away, The crowd, numbed and guilty, went to witness it. Safe now to write a little poem. It will face up to the mess, the broken bodies, etc., and hint at something darker. It will have a fighting title. And a poem called Penalties. No one is having a breakdown in an upstairs room. I hope not, anyway. Down here we accept one another and make small adjustment to our bodies. There is one breast missing since last time, and we fancy we don't know which without ungallant probing, without disturbing the memory. At dinner we are unfussy, passing over the pork, a persistent vegetable, the nearer of two wines, yet we eat modestly and hope others take heart from this. So here we are again, not quite the same people, but from afar near enough. Here we are after 20 years or so, my eyes not quite seeing. Across the table, her fingers in his hair, stranded without hair. The young wife fills a gap and does it well. Strange to think that one of us sitting here is dead. In panic, someone will seize his neighbour and hurry off to make, well, love, just in case. And we part thinking ourselves reasonably in luck. When next we meet, another one of us will be missing. And we are now older, dreaming of replacements. The book has a lot of variety. As I say, I think that the long poems are the most impressive. You should get him here to read. I got terrified when he asked me to airmail him 60 copies of the book. I actually discovered an ingenious way to do it, which is there's a thing called accelerated surface post, worth knowing about. Sounds most implausible. But books get to Papua New Guinea that way in 10 days. At about half the price. Peter Russell now lives in Italy. This is a selection of, yeah, absolutely. Just outside Florence, too, even wiser. This book is a selection of his poems up to about 1975. It's actually subtitled Selected Poems 1947 to 75. I just want to read one piece, which is from a book we in fact published first about 1972 called The Elegies of Quintilius, in which Peter Russell, who is, I think, one of the most genuinely learned people I know, although he never went to university, pastiches Latin poetry in the fiction of translating a poet called Quintilius, who in fact never existed, although it does appear that one or two of the reviews of the first edition of the book were under the apprehension that maybe it was a translation and Peter Russell was doing a wonderful job on him. Actually, I've always imagined, if I've ever thought of translating Ovid, which I haven't very often, but I've always imagined that a decent translation of Ovid would sound like Peter Russell's Quintilius. I think that they're very funny poems, perhaps in a rather donnish academic way, but the jokes in them are good. The jokes in the notes to the book, The Elegies of Quintilius, are an absolute delight for classical scholars. This is the first of the series of six elegies called Daunia, Daunia being the name of the lady in question. Generous wick with the oil of the coconut palm, kindling each evening our own nuptial flame. Witness you were of the love act a number of times nightly in the city of Sfax in my youthful days, till Daunia left me to shiver in an empty bed. She it was who originally insisted on this petting and kissing by lamplight till long after dawn made weak the once upright flame at our bedside. Possible outcomes or permanency never entered our heads that were full of sex games and gladiators. The arena by day and the dust of our bed by night with the trim wick glowing and the wail of musicians on the other side of the forum with flutes and a drum loading the evening air with voices and wine kept us too busy for thoughts of a home or of infants. Now she has left me. Now she's run off with another. Rotten scum of a fellow from Rome with more gold in his purse than ever my father had before the drachma crashed and the markets went dead. With him she's gone off. They leave on the next boat for Rome. She knocked on my door in the morning to say goodbye. Don't weep, Quintilius. You will soon find another nice girl to warm you in bed and wash your hair before sleep. You'll forget your sweet Dania long before she ceases to long for a former lover in Sfax. I couldn't bear to hear more of these words, so quickly went out into the backyard with the chickens and wept, leaving the rest of her message to fall on the polished brass knocker, my father's pride. I had often thought I was going to end up a failure. At the worst, I had thought, this girl will be a good wife to me now I'm a failure at everything else, unbraiding her hair in the evening and lulling our babes to sleep as the sun goes down on our modest house. But had never troubled to ask her. Now she has gone, and the bright streets of Rome will claim her the rest of her girlish days. Perhaps I shall die single, not troubling to cook myself breakfast, or keep more than a few half bottles in the house of cheap red wine and a jar of black olives. Delicacies cost such a lot. Without her to want an occasional bracelet, I shall die with my palms clean of the dust of gold and be none the worse off. Oh, Mother Venus, what can your poor sons do, deserted by girls they have ever taken for granted? It hurts. Send either another Greek courtesan who is tired of life in the brothels and is seeking a home modest enough for dull me to provide for, or end this unnecessary slowness of days. I'll make her a good husband, I promise you. Just find me a house with a field not too far from the city, with space enough for chickens, a cock, a pig, and a cow. Let it have three or four gnarled and split olive trees with ripe berries in early November. Let it have ample room for the winter wheat and a terrace of large-leaved vines for the summer months. And don't forget to remind your old father to make sure there's rain when it's needed. Dear goddess, I'd soon take root at the edge of the city of Sfax, provided my new wife doesn't turn out a scold and further invasions don't interrupt the quick-footed hours with parties of homeless and hungry looking for food. What a fool I was not to ask that girl at the time. Her soft fingers made sweet our evening food, and she never refused to delight in the joys of love. I doubt I shall find another, at least in this age. The sequence then goes on to describe the further adventures of Quintilius.
Is there any chance of him coming?
I don't know. I don't think he's planning a trip to England for some time. He was over for the Cambridge Poetry Festival 2 or 3 years ago. If he does, I will. Another expatriate, since we seem to be on people in very far flung. In fact, all these books, it suddenly hits me, what is wrong with Anvil Press? We publish poets who do not live in England, so no wonder we can't sell their books. Peter Wiggum, who actually was also living in Italy at the same time that Peter Russell first went in the early 60s, is now in California. He's been threatening to come back to England and indeed wants to go and live back in North Italy, but never seems to be able to raise the airfare. In fact, last week I had to bail him out of New York, where he was stranded, moneyless, earning $4.50 an hour working in the Barnes & Noble record store as a, you know, sales clerk, desperately needing $250 to buy an affair back to Berkeley. So, like a good publisher, I got a friend in New York to give him the money on strict condition it did not get spent on the things that poets usually spend money on. I'd like to read a couple of little extracts from a long poem called The Ingathering of Love, which is, an autobiographical love poem with a very English background. And then I'd like to read just a short selection of epigrams, lyrical epigrams, translated is too strong a word, very loosely based on some Tibetan poems. This is the opening section of The Ingathering of Love. I should also say Peter Wigham is perhaps known to some of you as the translator of the Penguin Catullus, Poems of Catullus, which I do think is a wonderful book. The introduction to that book is the best essay on Catullus that I know. And the translations are, I think, very beautiful. What can I hope for from this love of mine? To live another's life, be you, walk in your raincoat in wet country lanes, stretch in your chair, or feel the grape squirt against your teeth. Vignettes of firelit or of summer evenings, of autumn when the shiftless skies move out of tune, when the trees ache, and a damp air indistances the nearby fields. What can I hope for from this love of mine? All day the willow weeps by the summer house. Bits of grass, the detritus of summer, lie on the floor. The birds are muted, appeased by nest building and egg laying. A plane fades like mild thunder, and the sun, an atmosphere, pervades the grey sky. Walk on precarious heels across the sodden lawn, old clothes, hair anyhow. The sun will not come out, no, but traces of that lightning struck from your eyes a day now years ago flicker from where you walk. So bird, rose, tree, lawn rearrange themselves, the ambience changes, all is framed for you, and you, the picture, blank to other eyes. The poem is about 20 pages long. I'll skip at least 10 pages. It was in one of those old stone houses in Monmouthshire that we first met. The flagged kitchen filled by a battered refectory table. A whole family sprawled there, gossiping. And you walked in from a side door in a swathe of sunlight. Was it farm eggs? Or something about cutting a hedge? Or one of those dances we all went to? I recall the impatient sun through the low windows describing your neck and chin. I recall how you walked and stood free with your legs as girls who have no thought of getting married walk and stand, gaucherly, a little astride, a light cotton skirt loose on your hips. It is used by our children now for dressing up. Laughing immoderately, they stumble about in its neglected folds. Pausing fractionally, they hesitate when the cloth suddenly tears. That laughter is caught like tears in the groin, as the swirling usk catches carleon, as we first caught hold of each other thoughtlessly with our tongues and fingers' ends. We could have lived no other life but this. The centre drives, the reef forms, your acts and mine, a network of peripheries, never still. The coral blossoms. The petals, in lovers' shoes, in shopping baskets, up the Woodstock and the Banbury Road. A world refracted in spring wind and rain. Wet pavements, lips and eyes dissolving as the petals fall. The weight of ocean, almond and cherry falling in the face of dreams. We could have lived no other life but this. The Lifetimes of the Sixth Dalai Lama are a series of 30 epigrams. As I say, very loosely based on the sixth Dalai Lama, who I think was an 18th century character, 17th century, 1683 to 1706. His name is unpronounceable. Sangsdbyangsodbyamtso. He wrote poems and had a fairly scandalous life. Or, as Peter Wiggin puts it in the note prefacing these versions, by 1701, his aversion to the conventual disciplines of the Potala Palace had become a matter of scandal and seemed likely to provoke political unrest. Shortly after his solemn consecration at the age of 13, the young pontiff began to display a compulsive attraction for the pleasures of downtown Lhasa. Okay. Number three. We have met in the valley of the South Forest. No eyes but yours and mine and bird eyes among the branches. Talkative parrot, do not broadcast our happiness from the crossroads. Keep in your crop the minutiae of our encounter, the detail of gesture you have witnessed. And number five. A pattern of birds, crossed twigs, and the last milestone have brought love like luck to these two, met in this hedge tavern, where an old woman ladles out wine to them. She will go on serving wine on the periphery of their lives, at parting, at welcoming, at childbirth. My loved one of recent nights has gone. I consult the diviners. Why does the artless face of a girl I have never met come to me in my dreams? She passed me, leaving a trail of perfume to elaborate my desire. I followed through the streets. In a secluded alley, two strangers made unthinking love. That done, we parted. I am the fool who found a coloured stone that could be precious and threw it unthinkingly away. In summer, this reed patch tainted the lakeside water and couched the tranquil young goose that nested here. Now, winter crackling coats the separate stalks. The reflection of those days is like white coal, and the young goose, lacking fire and a mirror, stands dejectedly on the bank. In the oasis of the day, she is with me, but I cannot, for reasons of circumspection, touch her small hand too often, or let my eyes too lovingly rest on her amber skin. When night returns and sleep is a mirage, hands, fresh from her touch, flutter before my eyes, eyes in which hers are reflected, ogle me from the darkness. And the last one in the series. Frost lacing late summer grass gives warning of autumn winds. The honeyed season is over. The bee takes leave of the flower. I bow myself from your bed. Johannes Bobrovsky, the East German poet, died in 1965. At the early age of 43, he was also well known as a novelist. No, that's not true. In his lifetime, he was well known as a short story writer. His novels, I think, were almost all posthumous. At any rate, the one that was made into a film recently for East German television was certainly posthumous, I think. Maybe it's two novels and three collections of short stories. And I think only in his lifetime, certainly only two collections of poems. And then there were two subsequent volumes published after his death. To me, he's one of the most beautiful of contemporary poets. Beautifully translated by Ruth and Matthew Mead. They're very mysterious poems, and I think in all of the three or four that I'd like to read, you'll sense his involvement with nature, landscape, and what may appear to be a very depersonalized kind of landscape. Actually, his landscape is very mythical, and I think one's sense of its historical and political dimensions only builds up when you read a lot of his poems. I don't think I can give any sense of that. One of the poems I will read is mysteriously entitled Lake Ilmen 1941, and it's the date that is the, as it were, the thing that makes it a political poem, because from the poem you can't tell a vast amount. But he was fighting on the Polish and Russian front at around that time. Landscape with birds. Old plains of last year's grass, greater. The hills all sunk, the lake white stretching past the horizon. From there the crane, high, above the light, following its own shadow. And a voice like a grove and full of green shadows, wet when the water recedes. Lark, the stone burst on which you sang, morning after morning before the leather tent. Only one man heard you, Temujin, waking, heard you. Once having slept an eternity, walled up, they broke open the cave, seven men stepped out. A tree has grown round me with hard bark like sleep, the raven preens its plumage in the branches overhead. My tree trembling where my heart beats against you, winterly. But your bark will not burst, even if the snow should powder as the raven moves its wing. The only reference in that poem, which perhaps is some clue to its, as it were, real, not real, but to its major meaning, is that Temujin is another name for Genghis Khan. Well, this is Lake Ilmen, 1941. Wilderness, against the wind, numb. The river sunk into the sand. Charred branches, the village before the clearing. Then we saw the lake. Days of the lake, of light. A track in the grass. The white tower stands like a gravestone deserted by the dead. The broken roof in the core of crows. Nights of the lake, the forest falls into the marshes. The old wolf, fat from the burnt-out sight, startled by a phantom. Years of the lake, the armoured flood, the climbing darkness of the waters. One day it will strike the storming birds from the sky. Did you see the sail? Fire stood in the distance. The wolf crossed the clearing. Listen for the bells of winter, howls for the enormous cloud of snow. It had never occurred to me before, but I suppose it's possible that Miłosz got the title of his own book of poems from this poem of Borowski's. I shall check that out. Latvian songs. My father, the hawk, grandfather, the wolf, and my forefather, the rapacious fish in the sea. I, unbearded, a fool, lurching against the fences, my black hands strangling a lamb in the early light. I, who beat the animals instead of the white master, I follow the rattling caravans on washed-out roads. I pass through the glances of the gypsy women. Then, on the Baltic shore, I meet Wekshkul, the master. He walks beneath the moon. Behind him, the darkness speaks. And Russian songs as some sort of counterpart to that. Marina, singing down from a tower across a landscape of rocks, three rivers beneath her feet, but night and the shadows of wind in flight. Beautiful lover, my tree, high in your branches, with brow bared to the moon, I sleep, buried in my wings. I sleep, you give me a grain of salt scooped from an uncrossed sea. I give you a drop of rain from the land where no one weeps.